everybody. I am Cora Louise Bellswood, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And if I should fall by the wayside this morning or anything happens that I can't go on, you could call on Darla or Nancy. Either one of them can tell my story for me. They've heard it so many times. As you grow older, your waist gets bigger and your voice gets smaller. So I'm glad for the microphone, and I hope you can all hear me. It used to be I could talk in a room like this without a microphone and you could hear me. I got a card not long ago from a smart alecky friend. It said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know I can't do either one. And I thought, gee, that's really pretty cute, isn't it? And then I want to tell you, I have been going through a few days when that has absolutely been the case with me. I have been in a real sort of alcoholic with it. I've been trying to get ready to take a trip with my daughter and her husband, and I have decided it's a trip that I never should have planned to take. I just shouldn't be taking this trip. It's too complicated. I'm not going to go into all the details, but I've got, among other ancient geriatric problems, I have breathing problems, and this is a trip on a train through the high country in the West, and I have been trying to arrange about oxygen. From Leland, Mississippi to Santa Fe to the train to Denver to back to... I'm not going to tell you all about it. It's too complicated. I'm not sure it's not impossible. But at any rate, thank God I'm here among all of you. And it really gives me a wonderful feeling to be here. It's been a marvelous weekend. I appreciate so much being at home. I'm grateful, first of all, today, of course, to be sober today. And I'm grateful that Bill and Dr. Bob met 64 years ago, the 10th of May, and started this process that's still going on all over the world, as Charles told us last night. One alcoholic speaking to another, speaking in the language of the heart. Second only to my gratitude for sobriety, I'm grateful for the opportunity that I had to work in our general service office as a trusted servant for 15 years. It was one of the great experiences of my life. It was a learning experience for me. I loved it. And I can remember that even during the conference, when it would get to be like Thursday, and everybody was sick and tired of everybody else by then, and I would have been happy to use a pistol on one or two of them if I'd had it. And I thought, but these are trusted servants. These are your blood brothers and sisters. You're all members of AA together. Get with it. And I would be ready to put down my pistol and forgive them for everything and think that maybe the ones from California and Florida had just stood in the sun too long and their brains got fried. Maybe that was the trouble. I could spend my whole time this morning talking about the office and the work we do there. It did show me the real reach of AA, and I saw it almost at once. Because when I went to work there, it was just 2 weeks before the International Convention in Toronto in 1965. And everybody was somewhat busy getting ready for the convention, and they didn't really have time for the new girl on the block. So they just piled my desk up with what we called circulating folders. These folders contained the correspondence of each day. The letter we received and the reply to it. And they said, if you read these, you'll get some idea about what goes on here. Well, I did. I mean some idea. The letters came from all over the world. Many of them had to be translated. We had on the staff, in the secretarial staff, girls who could translate both French and Spanish, who were French and Spanish, so that they had no problem with it. There were letters from professional people. There were letters regarding public information. There were the usual letters of complaint about, where's my literature order? I've sent it 3 weeks ago and I haven't got a thing yet. We had all of those. It was absolutely wonderful to me. I would go home each night and I would tell my husband, you don't have any idea what goes on there. You just can't believe it. You can't believe it. I had no idea, and I've been in AA 8 years at that time. I had no idea of the reach and the grasp of our ability to extend the hand of AA to anyone, anywhere, who reached out for help. And this was from a bunch of people who at one time couldn't even sign their own name. And we were able to put together an outfit like this, where rooms like this, not just all over this country and Canada, but all over the world, are filled with people like you and me, who come together to share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. Now, I tell you, I would like to talk about the office forever, but I know that's not why you asked me to come. You asked me to come and tell you my story, and I have never found this easy to do, but I have really always welcomed opportunities to do it, because it is the story of the transforming experience of my life. Because during the years that I drank, I became the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. Destructive, irrational, unpredictable. Thanks to AA, I have at least been in the process of trying to become a new and different kind of person, together with all of you and with the power greater than myself that I call God. Now, I never was, and I don't think I am now particularly, appearances notwithstanding, a person who had a great deal of faith in her own ability to accomplish anything worthwhile. But I found out here, it doesn't really matter whether I have faith in myself or not. As long as I have faith in the power greater than myself, faith in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, everything will be all right. I told you that I was grateful, and I wish I could even count the ways, but I can't. I do. It's been my habit ever since I came into AA, and I don't know why, to speak about the most recent things in my life first. I've been through a really difficult 2 years, probably the most difficult 2 years of my life. Don't pay any attention to me if I get weepy. They used to call me the staff weeper. They could count on me to cry for anything. Anyway, a year ago this past January, my oldest daughter died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. She had been diagnosed with the disease the same day that Jackie Kennedy died of it. And she had outpatient treatment and was in remission for about 2 years, and we thought everything was fine. And 2 years ago in July, it reoccurred. Only this time it had changed character. It was very much more serious. And from July to January, she was in the process of the most intense treatment that you can have. Really, one day it will be looked upon as barbaric when they have a better way to do it. You go through this, even when it doesn't work, you're glad you went through it because you had to try everything. This was, I don't even want to call it difficult. It was a grace-filled time for both of us. It was for everyone who was associated with my daughter, because she became so loving, so outgoing, so warm, so cooperative. I found myself able to do things for her that I didn't think I could do. I found myself not worrying, not full of anxiety, none of that. And finally, someone said to me, "Who helps you?" Well, I know who helps me. People like you. AA helps me. The AA program helps me. The power greater than I am helps me. My sister has been desperately ill this past year, and I've been back and forth to Sewanee, Tennessee, where she lives, trying to help her. People say, "Who helps you?" The higher power helps me, and the AA program. And I don't know how all those normal people out there who seem to get along okay, I don't know how they manage without it. I could not. And thank God I don't have to try. When I went to my first AA meeting in September of 1957, I was really at the end of my rope. I had used up all my resources. These had been considerable. At that time, I never would have believed that the day would ever come when I'd be able to look back on those years and accept the fact that they probably were the necessary preparation for the kind of thing that happened to me when I came into AA. I thought I was different. I had to come here to find out that I'm just like you. We may be as different as our fingerprints, but we have very many characteristics in common. And I found out that I was no different from anybody else in this room when it came to my major problem. I don't think I would have believed what I saw in those rooms if I'd read it in a book. But I believed what I saw, because I believed that you knew what you were talking about. And I believed this almost at once. I really didn't have to be convinced, which was something of a miracle in itself. I believed you had suffered what I was suffering and had been where I was, and that if this had worked for you, perhaps it could work for me. That didn't seem likely. And I couldn't imagine ever being grateful. My goodness. After all I had put myself and all my family and my close friends through, what did I have to be grateful for? Nothing, I thought. Nothing. I was a victim, I felt. I learned a lot of things here. And when I say I learned things, I don't mean I ever learned anything once and for all. I have to do these things over and over and over again and keep reminding myself. As during this past week, when I've been in this alcoholic anxiety attack or whatever it's been. Oh, all right. Is that okay? Okay. I learned that I am not in control, that I don't control anything or anyone, not even myself, by my efforts alone. I need help. The kind of help that I get from people like you. And from the power greater than myself. I learned I don't have to be a winner. That maybe the only time in my life that I ever truly won was when I seemed to be losing. For instance, when I lost the battle with booze. I learned that I have the right to be wrong. That I have the right to make mistakes. That I even have the right to fail. Things that matter deeply to me. The only thing that would be really fatal would be if I should cease to care, cease to be fully committed to the principles of this program and to the power that I call God. Now, I began to drink with anything like regularity, sort of late in life for an alcoholic. I was 26 years old, married, and the mother of two little girls. My husband was overseas during World War II. And I went back to Suwanee to sit out the war. My mother had a house there. And I moved back there with my two little girls. And I discovered that there were a lot of other women like me there, what we call war widows. Our husbands were overseas, and we were home taking care of the babies. And we used to like to get together in the afternoon, sit on the porch and rock, and let the children play in the yard. And we would share our experience, strength, and hope with each other over a few drinks. And I thought this was wonderful. And I thought, golly, where has this custom been all my life? I have been missing something big. And I began to look forward to that time of day. As a matter of fact, I became a clock watcher. This became the time of day that was most important to me. Now, someone else mentioned this. I think it was Jerry. I found out drinking meant something to me that didn't mean to these other people. They enjoyed drinking and they drank well. But I don't think they were watching the clock and waiting for the time to come when they could take the first drink. Now, it turns out that I had an enormous capacity. The well-known hollow leg that we hear so much about, and God knows I was going to need it as time went on. But I was proud of this. We were going on a picnic or something. They would say, let Cora Louise drive. She never gets tight. Wasn't that wonderful? Never gets tight, that friend. My husband came home from overseas, and he noticed that I had become a daily drinker. He didn't particularly complain about it. As a matter of fact, he became a daily drinker himself. But I thought, well, I had unrealistic expectations. I always had unrealistic expectations, and I think I maybe still do. But I thought when my husband came home from overseas that everything was going to be just perfect. It would be like a fairy godmother waving her wand over us, and we would live happily ever after. That all my problems, and I had had some real ones while he was overseas, that they would go away. Well, it didn't quite work out like that. He had been overseas with the 5th Marine Division, and I'd been at home sitting on the porch drinking bourbon, watching my children play in the yard. I had a few other little problems going on, too. And after he'd been home for a while, we decided that we would go to New York for a year and let him get an advanced degree on the GI Bill of Rights. We went to stay for 1 year, and we stayed for 35. And that was great. Now, this was something else where I had unrealistic expectations. We're going to a place that I liked. I enjoyed what you did in New York. It was going to be a new and exciting and wonderful life, and everything was going to be great. But I took myself with me. And lots of things were great, but lots of things weren't so great. One of the things that wasn't so great was that I had developed this symptom. I shook all the time. And this was not from drinking too much. I just shook, period. Around the clock, I shook. And I was going to Columbia. My husband was going to Columbia. And I had to take an exam. And the professor dictated the question. And my hand was shaking so I couldn't write. I had to remember all the things he said. My husband caught me marching up and down in the hall outside of the room. He said, what's wrong with you? I thought you had to take an exam. I said, that's the idea. I'm supposed to, but I can't write. Well, we decided something had to be done about this. So I went through a battery of tests and doctors and all that kind of thing. And it was finally decided that I should go into psychotherapy. And this really burned me. We had the problems, but I had to go to the shrink. Now, this was 1946, I'm talking about, 47. Not every single person I knew was having psychotherapy. The only people I knew who were having psychotherapy were people that I thought were crazy. And I didn't think I was crazy. However, they threw me this line of jazz and so on, and I said, all right, I'll try. I really did. want to make a success of this marriage, and I really did want to be a good mother to these children. So I was prepared to do whatever I had to do. And I began psychotherapy. And I went for 9 years. They had told me it would be very quick, you know. It's 8 months. You'd be okay. 9 years later, still drinking, falling down drunk, I left the treatment situation. Anyhow, when I had been going to him 4 and 5 times a week, for about a year and a half, I went to a party one night. And I still think that I drank in the usual manner and in the usual amounts. Only this time something very peculiar happened. I got drunk. And I had a blackout. And I was not prepared for either one of these things. I didn't approve of people getting drunk. I thought if you couldn't drink well, that meant like me, you shouldn't drink at all. You can see I had a long way to fall from my lofty perch. I had never even heard of a blackout at this time. I had fallen down a flight of stairs and landed on my head on a stone terrace the night before, and I thought I had a concussion, and that's why I couldn't remember anything. I was too ashamed of the cause of the fall to go to a regular doctor, but I did discuss it with the therapist, and he said all the things I wanted to hear. He said, "Oh, don't worry. This is the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally." He said, "Perhaps until we resolve some of these difficult problems that we're dealing with, perhaps you should be extra careful about your drinking." And I agreed with him. Careful. I was going to be extra careful. I didn't want that to happen again. And I set out to be careful. And I tried every way I could think of to be careful, and every way anybody could suggest to me to be careful. The problem was, though I didn't know it, my family didn't know it, my friends didn't know it, I had already lost the ability to be careful. I had already crossed whatever that invisible line is that separates those people who can drink from those who can't. It would have been impossible for me to believe then that I had reached the point of no return as far as drinking was concerned. And I most heartily did believe that if I could only find the key that would unlock the door and emancipate what everyone referred to as the real me, that I would be able to put some order in my life. And that in that order, drinking would fall into its proper place. Well, I set out on this search for the will-o'-the-wisp known as the real me. And I endowed this search with every ounce of energy and imagination and resourcefulness that I had. And it was plenty. I continued to search for it in psychotherapy. The therapist can hardly be blamed for not being able to help me with a problem which I never mentioned again. I spoke of it the first time, and I never mentioned it again. I meant I wanted to. I planned to. I would write it down the night before. And on my way to his office the next day, I would go into such panic I'd have to make up something that would account for the sort of condition I was in. I never showed up drunk, but I showed up blind with a hangover. He got his degree. He could smell. He could see. He's bound to have known what was wrong with me. But I was having the kind of therapy where you present. They didn't ask you questions. You had to present. Well, I wasn't presenting. Believe me, I didn't present a thing. Not that. Everything else in the world, but not that. Many years later, after I was in AA, he called me up. He'd heard me on the radio and recognized my voice. He said, I want you to know I learned something from you. He said, I knew you had a drinking problem. He said, I won't take anybody now who has a drinking problem unless they go to AA and get straightened out first. This is no way for anybody to make any progress in therapy and continue to drink. And it's true, you can't. But you just keep acting out, so nothing gets solved. I looked for my answers in worthy causes, thinking that if I could find something bigger than I was that I could throw myself into, then I wouldn't drink so much. But I didn't find anything that big. If you had an organization and you had a dirty job you wanted done, I was your girl. I would do anything to try to get a little self-respect from myself. Nothing worked. I worked hard, but I didn't gain self-respect. I sought for my answers in domesticity and home life. My house has never been so clean. I couldn't clean up anything on the inside, so everything on the outside had to be just so. I never have given so many parties. Such elaborate ones, because every now and then people would show up for a party and I wouldn't remember having invited them, and I'd have to send out the pizza or something quick in order to have something to feed them. I sought for my answers in my religion, which I had turned my back on a number of years before. I was busy, though, trying to make sure the higher power understood what my will for me was, which was that I would be able to drink well like I once had. I had to come here to find out it works the other way around. I even sought for my answers at Ebbets Field in the days when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. I was a big baseball fan. I adored the Dodgers and had been a Dodger fan ever since Jackie Robinson had signed up in 1946. The children went away in the summer. They spent the summer mostly with my mother. So the few controls that were in my life were gone. And the drinking always got very much worse. And I had a brilliant idea. I thought, if I had to go from Manhattan to Ebbets Field 77 times every summer and get home 77 times, maybe I wouldn't drink so much. So I got my family to go together and give me a season ticket to all the Dodger home games. And 77 times every summer I got on the subway and I went to Brooklyn. And 77 times I got home by the grace of God. Because I discovered beer. And the beer vendors discovered me. And when they used to come around at the end of the seventh inning, they'd put down three or four cans of beer by my seat and say, well, lady, I hope it doesn't go into extra innings for your sake, because we're not coming back. At the same time I was looking in all these places for this key, I, of course, always looked for answers in the content of a bottle. And here I really did always find a key. But it wasn't the one I was looking for. It was the key to a Pandora's box. And out of this box came this destructive, irrational, unpredictable female who scared everybody to death, including herself. I thought this creature that came out of the bottle was the real me, and that everything else was a fraud. The chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the life of all those people who were close to me by this attempt of mine to live two different lives at the same time, one on a somewhat rational plane, as rational as I was capable of being, and the other on this dark side. This finally just brought me to the point of despair where nothing worth effort anymore. The gap was too wide. The gap between this person who made attempts at worthwhile living, and this creature, who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned or kicked over every good thing that she did. This gap was too wide. I thought it could not be covered. It couldn't be spanned. And so I came to the conclusion that I was some sort of typhoid Mary of the human race. And I just spread destruction in my path, was the way I felt. And it was in this defeated and burnt out frame of mind that I showed up at my first AA meeting. Now, I hadn't been going to AA very long before I found that key. I didn't find it right away. It didn't open all the doors right away. It still hasn't, and it never will. But it began the process of opening one door at a time, as I can get the courage to look in. And I found the key that opened the first door when I was able to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, that there was nothing I could do to change that, but that I could change the meaning of it and take the destruction out of it by becoming a sober alcoholic one day at a time. I want to tell you about my last drunk. They say if you don't remember your last drunk, maybe you haven't had it. I hope I've had mine. I remember it well. It was the Friday before Labor Day, 1957, and I was expecting company for the weekend, so I had laid in heavy supplies of you know what, and I had been busy cooking and doing all kinds of things, getting ready for the company. And along about 4:30 in the afternoon, when I'd postponed taking the first drink as long as I possibly could, I knew about postponing when I came here because I'd been postponing for years. Along about 4:30, I couldn't postpone any longer, and I took the first drink. And with the first sip, I was just overwhelmed by a sort of sickening shock of recognition of the helplessness and hopelessness and near despair of my situation. I was so sick and tired of what booze did to me. I really hated it. And without a thought, I put the drink down. I went to the telephone and I called my husband. I had no plan of what I was going to say. For the first time in my life, I said something appropriate about my drinking. I said, please try not to be angry with me. I know I'll be drunk by the time you get home, but I hope it may be the last time. Then out of the blue came the words that saved my life. I said, if you'll call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to try it. I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I know if I am, it isn't my fault. But it will be my fault if I don't try to find out and do something about it. It doesn't cost a thing, so what do I have to lose? What do I have to lose? Only all those things that I had been struggling to get rid of all those years. And what I had to find instead were those things that I had been looking for such a long time. Well, I had told my husband that I'd be drunk by the time he got home, so I really did owe it to myself, didn't I? So I proceeded to have a few more drinks, and after the third drink, I always got telephonitis. I say I got to AA by the grace of God in telephonitis, and I started twirling the dial. I used to put notes on the telephone saying, do not use this phone. And I'd take three drinks and I'd say, that's ridiculous, and I'd stop. But I had to step back just a little bit. I began to call up everybody I knew and tell them my big news. Not one single person said you didn't need that. Not one. But I have to step back a little bit. About a week before this, I had called up the children's pediatrician, who was a neighbor and a friend, and asked him and his wife to come over for the evening. The problem I wanted to discuss with one of the children with him, and they came. When they arrived, I was not drunk, but I wasn't really what you would call sober. And I was being good hostess. I was pouring regularly. And I was telling him about this problem I had, and finally he said to me, "Stop. I have to say something to you. It's going to make you furious, but I should have done it a long time ago." He said, "You're not going to solve this problem, any other problem you've got, unless you do something about your drinking. It's out of control. And I want you to let me call Ruth Fox, who's a well-known psychiatrist in New York who specialized in alcoholism, and I want you to go to see her." Well, I was just as mad as he thought I was going to be. I wasn't mad at him. I was mad at Lee, my husband. I thought he'd ratted on me. As though this man had to be told, he got his degree too. And he'd seen me drunk any number of occasions. He once saw me bust open a dining room table that was made out of glass, banging a bottle down on it. Anyhow, I got rid of him as fast as I could. I said, "We'll have to find another way. No more money is going to be spent on me and my problems, but thank you very much." And I got him out of the house and tore into my poor husband. And he said he never did think that I was suicidal, but he thought I might have been homicidal that week. I was so awful. It was the worst week we ever spent, really. Anyhow, at the end of that week, I made the telephone call I've told you about, called up all my buddies, told them about my plan. Nobody said, "Don't do that." And I had no sooner hung up the telephone from making all these calls than it rang. And it was that doctor, the children's doctor, Milton Levine. He said to me, "Have you been thinking about the conversation we had last week?" I said, "It's uncanny that you should call right now." And I told him what had just happened. He said, "You agreed to go to AA?" And I said, "Well, yes, you don't think that's a good idea?" He said, "It's the best thing you could possibly do. But I wouldn't have dared suggest it." Why won't they dare suggest it? I don't understand it. They suggest everything in the world to you, but they won't suggest AA. They do now, I think. They didn't then. And I said, "Listen, Milton, now I'm scared." And I said, "Do you think it would be too tough if I asked Lee to go to an open meeting with me?" He said, "If Lee doesn't want to go, you call me. I'll go with you. Let's just go. Make sure you go." So I hung up the phone, and I was at the center of the universe. I had bits of bullet. And I had all the drinks you can imagine. I still have the check that I wrote to pay to the Greenwich Wine and Liquor Store for the delivery that he made. I don't know why they accepted the check. I could hardly read it, but I still had it. Anyhow, there wasn't going to be any AA meeting that night, in spite of my husband having called up to find out where they were meeting. There was no way I could have gone anywhere. My company began to arrive the next day, Saturday. I knew enough about AA to know that you didn't teach people to drink here. You taught them to stop. So I sat the entire weekend drinking Coca-Cola and water and looking pitiful and noble and deprived while they swilled down my booze. And Tuesday after Labor Day, as my sister was leaving, she said, "Honey, you've got to find a better way than this, because we can't stand you like this." So she left, and I threw up all day long. I was so nervous. I was so scared. I have never been this scared in my life, I think. I'll never forget how I felt when I walked out of the front door that night, standing at the top of the steps. thinking, boy, you've really done it now. You're about to take a leap into the darkness. Little did I know that that leap would turn out to be my leap of faith. And the darkness would be better than any light that I have ever known. We got in the cab and we went to the old Manhattan group, which met on East 32nd Street at that time, in the neighborhood which had not yet experienced urban renewal. In other words, it was run down. We got out of the cab and I said, what would my grandmother think if she could see me now? My husband was kind enough not to say, what would she think of what got you here? We paced up and down, up and down. And I said, suppose they want me to sign something. If I ever need a drink in my life, I need it now. If they want me to sign something, I'm shaking too much, I can't sign it. He said, come on, let's just go to the meeting. And if you have to have a drink afterwards, we'll get a drink. So we went to the meeting. It was the beginner's meeting. The man who was leading the meeting was from Knoxville, Tennessee. He looked like my father, and he sounded like my brother, both of whom were alcoholics. And I sat there, and I listened to every word he said. I had my head ducked down, hiding my face. Finally, he said, does anyone have any questions? My husband put his hand up and he said, what do you do when it gets to be that time of day and your anxiety is so intense you feel you'll die if you don't have a drink? He said, what's your monsoon hour, sir? And I said, he's not talking about himself, he's talking about me. And that was the beginning. Hey, I don't know what he said. I do know what he said. I know better than what happened yesterday what he said. I had been to every kind of fancy council that existed in the city of New York, and I had to be in a room like that with other drunks like myself to hear those home truths that I still don't hear anyplace else but here. Same home truths. Now, the thing that he said that turned the screw in my head was not something deep, believe me. He said, you can't be a little bit alcoholic any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. It just depends on how far the condition has progressed. And this made sense to me. I knew about my father's alcoholism, my brother's alcoholism. I wasn't like that. When they drank, that's what they did. They drank. They didn't do anything else till they had to end up in the hospital. I did other things. But I was a little bit alcoholic, I thought. A little bit alcoholic. That's funny. But at any rate, then he talked about two-bit therapy. I guess it's nickel therapy, called it then. I guess it's $2 therapy now. Telephone call, face you buy a cup of coffee, all this. These are the things you do to stay away from the first drink. He talked about the 24-hour plan. And I was soaking this up like a sponge. We went downstairs from that beginner's meeting to an open meeting. In New York, you had three speakers at open meetings. They hoped if they didn't get you with one, they'd get you with another one. And they tried to have some newish people, a woman and a man with longer sobriety. This night, there were three speakers, all men who had been on the Bowery. Well, the wife of the man who had been leading the beginner's meeting was fanning herself. Said, oh, I do hope you'll go to another meeting tomorrow night. Most of them are not as rough as this. We usually have a woman speaker. And I smiled at her. My husband said, do you want to go? You never did anything like this. Maybe I shouldn't have brought you here. I said, why don't you shut up and let me listen to what they're saying? And he looked like somebody had thrown cold water over him. Not because I had been rude. He was accustomed to having me be rude to him. But because I had not threatened to cut his legs off for bringing me there. This was a miracle. I mean, I don't know. I use the word advisedly. I think the word is meaningless if you use it too often and about too many things. But for me to listen to this and never once question whether I should be there or not was, for somebody like I was then, this was absolutely amazing. My husband said to me, something different was sitting beside me than what I had brought there. A different person, somewhat different. The only thing that I thought was not that I shouldn't be here with people like this. I never did anything like this. I thought if they can have been so sick and lost so much and had so little to get well for, if they could do it, here I could. So AA became for me a kind of school. And really it still is. Where I learned the things that I always wanted to know, which were how to lead a life that had some meaning and some purpose. And in all of this, I found the incentive from the example of people like you, and I found the courage from your unfailing strength and support to begin to face the realities of my own life on a daily basis, and a whole new world opened up. You taught me the difference between despair and hope, between futility and faith and a kind of fulfillment. You really taught me the difference between slavery and freedom. I do not have the words, and I will never have the words that can express the depth of my gratitude for all of this. And so, over the years, I have had to give partial evidence of my gratitude by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it. For a number of years now, because of my own health and health of people in my family and so on, I've not been able to be as active as I once was. And as I used to be, very active. But I'm more grateful than I ever was. Now, I have one story that I always tell whenever I speak. Not that it's the worst thing I ever did, but it does sort of describe to you what my life was like and what was expected of me and what I did with it as a result of alcoholic drinking. I was invited once to speak at a group anniversary in New York, and they used to say no souls were saved after 10 o'clock, and it was getting close to 10. So I left the stoke out. The man came up and grabbed me by the throat afterwards and said, "The reason I asked you is because I want you to tell about that dinner party." So I tell about the dinner party now. I don't want you to grab me by the throat. My husband was an Episcopal clergyman. He was chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. He was a full-time professor, and he had an association with the church in New York on Sundays. And a couple of years before I came into AA, he asked me if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and staff from his department at NYU. And I, of course, was willing to do this, accepted gladly, and I worked very hard to make this party a success. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the day of the party, I was done with my work, and I was tired, and I thought it'd be a good idea to take a little nap before the company came. And then I had one of those inspirations that occur with some frequency to alcoholics. I thought, I believe I'll have a little glass of sherry to help me become drowsy. Now, I knew a little glass of sherry did not make me drowsy, that it took a little bottle of sherry to make me drowsy. And I knew long before AA that it was the first drink that got me into the trouble. But I didn't know how to stay away from the first drink. I still thought I could apply reason. And so I applied reason. I said any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this. And I took the first drink. And you know what happened. I didn't have the luck to pass out. I never did. I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I rarely did that either. I showed up at this party. And I showed up almost falling down drunk, muttering what I hope was a stream of incomprehensible gibberish. Because what I had to say was highly uncomplimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that most people associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party were strangers to me. Most of them came from the Midwest, from a sort of temperance-type background. We were Episcopalians, and Episcopalians have a sort of relaxed attitude toward drinking. That's not to say they were relaxed about my drinking, which they did not think was social. But they were, and on the whole, they're relaxed about drinking. These people didn't even smoke, and in these days, everybody smoked. These were the kinds of people that I call squares. And I called them that at the top of my lungs all evening long. Now, you talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, clergyman's wife, the hostess, drunk and disorderly. And I had the nerve to be referring to these people in what I intended to be uncomplimentary terms. The morning after this party, my remorse was spectacular. I just wanted to find a hole and crawl into it with the rest of the rats. I never wanted to see the light of day again. But I was so wrapped up in my own little alcoholic trap, so involved in my own misery, that I wasn't even able to tell this poor man that I had disgraced and humiliated, that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know I was sorry. No one would behave this way if she could help herself. I don't know whether he knew that or not. He certainly knew that I no longer drank because I had unresolved personality problems. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. Now, you would think in my life and circumstances that a performance like this would constitute a bottom, but I didn't draw any such conclusion. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. But I did decide that something had to be done about the drinking. And I set out to do it with indifferent success. But I don't recommend my system to anyone who is new and who hasn't already tried it, because I learned some new things about loneliness. I had thought I knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely, with a wonderful husband and two marvelous children and what could have been an interesting life, the fact that I had these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness only convinced me that I was a freak and reinforced all my feelings of failure and inadequacy. But after this party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing, because I decided not to do any drinking at all when other people were around. And before long, I, who had been a gregarious kind of person, no longer cared very much about being around people. I didn't want to plan to do things with the children in the evenings or during the weekends. I didn't even care if my husband didn't sit and talk with me after the children went to bed at night. I used to say, just come in there and play on your typewriter. When I die, I have somebody play the typewriter. Don't get them to play the organ or the piano. Play the typewriter. That's all I ever hear. You know, this was a really sick kind of loneliness. It really was. When I think about those last years, this is what I remember, is this awful, hollow, lonely feeling that I had all the time. You know, It's easy for me to fall back into some of the old ways, as I've told you about this anxiety I've had about this trip and so on. And I've been doing all those things, you know, muttering curses under my breath and thinking I'm no damn good and I can't do anything right and I never could do anything right and I kick the furniture and slam the drawers and do all that. And I remember once, I'd been sober a good while too, I said to myself, what's so different about your life anyway, except that you're sober? Except that I'm sober. When I came to AA, the only thing in the world I was looking for, or even hoped to find, was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, all I have to do is to remember those two terrible last years when I drank alone, late at night, walking up and down the steps and through the halls of my house for going for one last drink always. And I remember how I used to think even then, there must be some purpose in this. I must be looking for something that's missing from my life. And I was right about that one thing. Even in my drunken confusion, I was right about that. I was looking for you. I was looking for people like you in rooms like this. I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. I'm grateful for God, to God, for helping me to find AA, for sending me here. And I'm grateful to AA for giving me my life. Thank you.